I'm speaking to Fran Foreman. Fran, you're one of the foremost photographic exponents of your generation who's actually taken it, along with a lot of other people, a step further through discovery. You were one of the first people to discover the use of the early use of computers to actually make collages and Photoshop One, if they had such a thing, back 20 years ago, when it must have been quite difficult to actually manipulate images, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. Well, I'm afraid by you claiming all this, which is true, it belies my age. But yes, I was very lucky because I started using Photoshop before there were layers in Photoshop. So I did a lot of save as-is. I mean, I could still do what I wanted to do. It was just more time consuming. But if I had to learn the software now, I think I would have probably given it up and found a different career. But I was lucky. I started early. And there were other people doing it before me. I don't want to claim that I was the first, but I was definitely early in the software world, which was good because I was a complete technophobe. I was completely disinterested in technology or computers until I discovered that you could actually make art with a computer. And once that became obvious, then I was off and running.
I think this has happened to a lot of painters as well as photographers. I mean, people like David Hockney have famously taken to drawing with an iPad rather than drawing with a proper pen and pencil and all that complicated stuff. Some of your images are still based in odd kinds of half-remembered mystical stories. I believe from reading some of your background that it comes from some stories that were told to you by your Odessan grandmother. And you can see it coming out in some of the pictures still, at a very 19th century horror-filled half-memories of small girls like Alice. Does that make any sense?
Well, I think it's true. It certainly hasn't been conscious until I had to stand back and look at the images that I was making, and then I could see a relationship. But I do remember being told stories as a little girl. My great-grandmother, Anna, died in 1955, but until then, she was quite vibrant and talked about her life. And she grew up around the same time as Chagall and some of the surrealists of that time. And so her stories were filled with magic and skyhooks and people flying through the air. And they were really quite stunning, these stories. And of course, they receded into the back of my mind until I started making this kind of art full time. And suddenly they reappeared. And I used old family photographs for quite a while until I ran out of my own family's photographs. And then people would give me old photographs from their attics, their found objects that they no longer needed. And those people became subjects of my imagery as well.
There's something very interesting about this, because those stories you're talking about had probably been part of passed on verbal narration for thousands of years even, and only disappeared with your great-grandmother's dead generation, who came to the States, started watching cheap TV and listening to the radio and watching films, and forgot all this past stories that had gone on for generations through the long Odessan winters and all that.
Yeah, that's probably true. I doubt that she watched a lot of TV, but they certainly listened for radio. I even have photographs of my great-grandmother with her four sisters and her mother. One of the things that's just fascinating, one of the very earliest composites I did was a photograph of those people, those women, and my two daughters, and myself, and my mother, and my grandmother, all in the same composite. And I can see this relationship. They all had very similar eyes. It was stunning. And so in seeing their visual relationships and their characteristics, it just helped me sort of connect to these people from my past. The other weird thing, which I now remember, is that the eyes they're so similar, but they almost look as if their eyes had come from East Asia in a way. There's just this sense of travel across the planet, this connection from east to west, and then through Europe, across the big pond, into the United States, around the United States. And despite all those years of travel, there's this relationship. And that's one of the things that I've tried to suggest in my imagery. And again, I'm not sure it was completely conscious, But just the sense of connection between these generations of people and cultures and locations, and also between people in the natural world. That's the other thing that's very important to me that I'm hoping to express in my imagery.
I love your images, Sandy.
Well, thank you.
I should say, well, not even, because I know you do a lot of book covers where obviously you're not completely free to do what you'd like to do. It has to fit into the format of the book and the style of the book, but we all need to pay the rent, I suppose, and everything. What are you working on at the moment? I believe you've got a very, very big exhibition coming up, or indeed it may already have happened, where you've got your work in the Smithsonian, which is a rare thing.
I'm very thrilled. It's not just my work. I'm part of a large exhibition called High Art. I think it's acquisitions from the last 10 years. And the Smithsonian, it's the Air and Space Museum component, does occasionally acquire art, and these will be shown in the gallery at the Smithsonian, which opens mid-July of this year, and I think runs through the rest of the year, maybe into January. And the images that they've acquired of mine are very different than what they usually have. What they usually have are photographs of astronauts and clouds and spaceships and stuff like that. But my images are fantasies of flight. And they're really fantasies that I had, but also that evolved from these stories that my great-grandmother told me about people flying in the air. There's an image, for example, of a child holding onto an armillary sphere, a 19th century version of what the cosmos might have looked like, and he's floating in the air. And there's another image of a woman being held aloft by butterflies. So these are all fantasies of flight. And it's very different than the Smithsonian's usual fare. So I'm really thrilled about it.
I'm glad they put it in, because one can get rather tired of pictures of astronauts and spaceships. After all, we've all seen enough Star Trek. And when we go and see the real thing, it's almost disappointing.
I don't think you'd be disappointed. The other photographers and artists in this exhibit are unbelievably talented people. So I'm just thrilled to be among them.
One of the things I was thinking of, that I've mentioned to one other photographer who's strayed into this area, is that it reminded me of album covers by a band called Genesis, who used to write little stories based on these fantasy stories that presumably one of their writers was told by some ancient relative as well. I don't know whether you ever heard of Peter Gabriel.
I love Peter Gabriel's music. I guess I probably in the recesses of my mind, there's some memory of Genesis. Of course, Peter Gabriel, I'm very well aware. I have tons of his CDs. There is no doubt that I have been influenced by artwork of the 60s and the 70s. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt. I have to tell you this, that before I became a full-time artist, I was a graphic designer. And before then, I was a psychiatric social worker for several years. And I actually felt that I was insufficiently motivated to be a good psychiatric social worker, because I was much more interested in designing the walls of my office space. And I collected album covers and I collected posters. And of course, during the 60s and the early 70s, the art world was just exploding. So there's no question that I was influenced by Monty Python's animation, early animation, and Terry Gilliam, probably the designer for Genesis. I don't know who that was, but I'm sure I must have seen their art. And it was very fanciful and very filled with color and stylized drawings. So yes, there's unconsciously, I'm sure, I tip my hat to those people, those early designers.
Oh, indeed. And it may be the stories as well. There was one particular that came to my mind called The Magical Box, in which a young girl is sucked into a magic box from which she can never escape, which seems to echo the kind of stories that people were told, little horror stories in the dark, eastern, snowy night. They maybe come from the same background. And of course, Terry Gilliam was, I believe, from your part of the world, so maybe had the same kind of background. I don't know.
That's interesting. Now you're going to make me do some research and figure this out. That's interesting. I mean, these stories are so universal. They're probably part of all of our collective unconscious. I'm sure Jung would have said something about this. It's not a surprise that these stories would really span cultures, these fantasies. I mean, they are horror stories, but they're also stories that were told to children maybe as a way to placate the children, but also to prepare them for what life was about to throw in their way.
A kind of warning story, a modern equivalent of Highway Code, how not to cross the road or something. avoid evil witches and flying demons, which seem to come up all the time. But no, this is fascinating. What do you say about being a psychiatric social worker? You worked with a lot of heroin addicts, have been very, very difficult indeed.
I mean, I liked the people quite a bit, but I was very ineffective in helping them overcome their addiction. I became quite frustrated with my ability to make much change in their lives.
I think heroin is quite popular. I've never tried it myself.
Well, good.
I've certainly never inhaled any, whoever said that famous thing.
I have no comment.
No, I have no comment to make either. It's terrible to be addicted to something apart from art and indeed comedy, which is something that gives pleasure to other people. Looking at your pictures, they give a great deal of pleasure to a lot of people. If I could afford walls, I would love to have some on it, as you say. It's been great to speak to you, Brad Foreman. You have a website, as most people do now. You haven't just arrived on Earth from some far-off place without electricity. And am I correct in saying it's franforman.com, FranForman.com?
Yes.
There is a whole page of these awards. I'm sure if they were French, as they no doubt were, did they come with big medals that you can wear at official events, perhaps?
Well, usually they come with paper medals, but yeah.
Oh, what a shame.
I stick them in a box in my studio, but yes, they do usually come with some sort of a certificate.
And of course, you're still teaching at Brandeis, where you were a student, I believe. So you're carrying on the good work to further generations.
I hope so. I hope so indeed. It's wonderful to talk to you, Tom.
Oh, you too. We must start up a fund to get you a new fan. I imagine that's the very same computer you're using in 1989.
Well, it's several generations later, but you can tell that I think I've overdone it. So I definitely need a new one.
Definitely. It sounds rather like my washing machine. But it's maybe less effective at cleaning clothes. But thanks very much, Fran Foreman, for speaking to me.
Thank you very much.
Take care now. Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Bye.